Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 106, Haikai no Michi, a conversation with Jim Cation. Jim Cation, last name spelled K-A-C-I-A-N, is the founder of the Haiku Foundation, whose mission is to archive the achievement of our first century of English language haiku, as well as to create greater opportunity for our second. The website, thehaikufoundation.org. He's also the founder and owner of Red Moon Press, redmoonpress.com, co-founder of the World Haiku Association, erstwhile editor of Frog Pond, the International Journal of the Haiku Society of America, and the author of 20 award-winning books of haiku. He's also an avid ocean kayaker. Here's one of his haiku. Beneath the Milky Way, an evening soft with moths. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Jim Cation, to Between the Lines. How are things in Virginia today?
Things are a little gloomy in Virginia today, but it's okay. We need the rain like most of the rest of the country, so we're happy to have it.
That's good, yeah. To help people, any weather is good for poetry, and I think especially haiku. You've got such a wide array of stuff. I've got so many questions. I'm excited to talk with you. I'm pretty much like a local person as far as haiku in my area on Long Island, and I've read a lot of books, but you have done a lot of world travel. You're like an ambassador for haiku. And one of the phrases that I've read of is Haikai no Michi, which is sort of like the way of haiku or the Tao of haiku, where I guess in classical times they would travel around and teach and sort of spread the message of haiku. So maybe you could say a little bit about how that, you know, integrates with your overall purpose with haiku.
I think that's a fair assessment, actually. I think it's always dangerous when you compare yourself to the wandering poets who perhaps were the first emissaries of haiku before it was even called haiku. But I do think that in reality that's what a large part of my life and mission has been. And it's been a wonderful trip. It's been good for haiku. It's certainly been good for me. I've enjoyed it. I've met lots of wonderful people. And I've been able to spend a lot of time and energy supporting and promoting my favorite genre and related genres around it. So yeah, I've been around the world twice in the name of haiku. I've been to many, many other travel spots. I've helped people to start their national foundations in 11 different countries. I don't want to take too much credit for that. I think largely what that means is when I came to visit, they used that as an excuse to get themselves organized to create such organizations. But I think that creating the energy and the involvement takes time and energy and sometimes the right person. And if I've been part of that process, I'm pleased and honored to know that.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because, I mean, a lot of people that I talk to, besides barely knowing much about haiku, they don't always realize how much of a worldwide phenomenon it's become. People always think of Japan, but to realize all the places, any particular countries or places that would stand out that you've been, that would be sort of unique or different.
Well, haiku is now written in more than 50 languages around the world.
Amazing.
So it's burgeoning, and you have to figure that if that's the case, it's something that people are responding to in a variety of cultures. I mean, we can't assume that what is traditional and valuable in classical Japanese haiku is exactly what people are responding to in Croatia or India or Iceland. What we can say is that there's something that people are finding in it around the world, in their own culture, in their own language, that resonates with them.
Yeah. Go on.
I was going to say, I don't want to say I think, one culture is better or more important or more advanced or anything like that, but I do want to say that I think that there are hot spots of haiku right now, and those hot spots, besides Japan, which remains very active, and, it's what people know of Japanese haiku now, for the most part, is half a century old. It's not any longer constrained in the way that we think of it, and in ways that we might constrain ourselves. But Japan is a very vibrant haiku culture. The United States, English language constituencies in the United States, the UK, but especially the United States, very hot. India is a very burgeoning haiku culture right now, and in many of the languages, in at least a dozen of the languages. And then also the Balkans seems to have taken over the notion of haiku, and that's a very odd thing. Both India and the Balkans, but particularly the Balkans, because while they are extremely literary and poetic in by nature and as culturally, it's also true that the primary poetic form for Balkan poetry is the epic. So you have very, very, very long historical poems, and suddenly there's this interest in this tiny little poem, which is sort of outside of their literary tradition. So you have this tradition in their cultures of long historical poems. I mean, really talking about thousands and thousands of lines. And suddenly they've come to adopt this very tiny form, which seems sort of the antithesis of what their poetic tradition is. But again, they must be finding something in that is of value to them, and
yes,
they've taken it up big time.
That's fascinating. In my experience, maybe it'll compare to what you know, but I've been sharing haiku with people, via email for about 12, 13 years or so, and what I find that'll interest a lot of people that aren't even much into poetry, I'd say there's two things that make it accessible. One is the gadgets, that are small size, the cell phones and stuff. Haiku fits perfect for that. And then a lot of people comment that they find it like a moment. It's like a moment of sanctuary, or this sort of mantric nice way to start their day. It's almost like the world has gotten busier and more frenetic, and the haiku comes in kind of give people this moment to just to mellow out. Does that sound familiar to your experience?
Well, I would certainly say that's one of the elements of that. The notion of haiku being allied with, let's say, Zen Buddhism, which has become, which when it came to the United States, say, was ubiquitous, is really not part of the Japanese tradition, really at all. There's a tiny part of it that might overlap. But when you go to Japan and you talk about things like that, they scratch their heads and they say, what are you talking about? What does that have to do with us? What does that have to do with haiku? So that's kind of our own reading on that, and I think that that's part of what's been exported. Because now when cultures take up haiku, they don't just take it up from Japan, they take it up from English. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's sort of an overlay that we've added to that. Having said that, also, I think now increasingly we're finding that the people don't need to find a Zen overlay to make it a valuable or worthwhile experience or poetic for them. But that certainly is part of what people have come to associate with haiku around the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear that because I personally find I appreciate the Zen quality of haiku. I know that there's kind of like two schools of people that are into the Zen of haiku and others that aren't. Maybe there's overlap. You know, I personally find that it enhances, you know, my appreciation for haiku. But it's interesting you're saying that for the Japanese, they don't really... It's sort of, maybe it's just sort of a natural part of their way, or they don't particularly associate it with Zen philosophy.
Well, you know, I think that it's actually a complex and layered argument about that.
Yeah.
But I would say that it's not quite the conscious attainment of mind space that we might think of it as it has come into the at least early in the English language adoption of like.
Yeah, that's a whole topic, and you know, it'd be a whole discussion right there. But it's not like sort of not worth getting into an argument or anything over that, as far as I'm concerned. I wanted to jump around a little bit. I wanted to mention one of your haiku because there's so many that I haven't read a lot, but the ones I like that I've read that I really like, they just you evoke the quality of the image or the sensory image. Plus, you fulfill what I've heard Cor Vandenhoel, one of his best suggestions I've heard to about haiku is to write half the poem, and I interpret that as you present an image or a mood and let the reader go with it. So one of yours that I have here, it goes like this: between statues, the rest of history, and that really just opens it up to let the reader fill in the blank. So I like that about it, and I also like there's not that many not the fairest category, but sort of political poems and haiku. And I think of Basho, the famous Summer Grasses, All That Remains of Great Warriors, Imperial Dreams, as probably one of the best anti-war peace political poems ever written. And yours fits in both those categories, the right half the poem and the sort of politics of it. I don't know if you meant to have all that in there.
Oh, very much so.
All right. So,
but you know, and then again, more. So I mean, I think there's several ways of reading the poem.
Yeah.
But certainly, I'm aware of the political ramifications, and of course, the historical ramifications of such a poem. It's it's an honor to have it mentioned with the Basho poem. You know, I would agree with your assessment. I think that there are not many haiku that are overtly political that have a wide readership. Let's put it that way. I think there are poets such as Marlene Mountain, who has been an outspoken political voice in haiku for a long time. But I don't think that as a whole, if you're reading haiku in the journals or something like that, that until recently you probably wouldn't find very many that had a political connotation like that.
Yeah, and I know some of Marlene Mountain's work. She writes some that are, I guess you do some of those, like one line all the way across. And I find it fascinating because it creates a different kind of rhythm than the, you know, 1, 2, 3 lines. Is there any, you know, do you just start experimenting with that? You do it once in a while? Or?
This is a pretty common topic, actually. Lots of people are talking about this right now. It seems to be like a hot topic. I've never been an advocate of one-liners or, for that matter, three-liners or anything else. It's not a conversation that interests me very much because, from my point of view, the poet's job is not to write three-liners. The poet's job is to write the poem.
Exactly.
And you need to do what the poem needs. If the poem needs to be expressed or is best expressed in three lines, then that's the form it ought to take. If it's best expressed in one line, then that's the form it ought to take. And there are different possibilities inherent in different formal approaches. So that's part of the poet's task.
Yeah.
Figure out what's going to work best here and then employ it.
That's why I agree with you, because when a lot of people ask me, you know, the 5-7-5 thing is still, so many people have that, you know, from grade school. Oh, that's what it's got to be. And I basically tell them, yeah, right, however it works out, you know, whatever sounds best as a poem. So I'm all with you on that. Let's see, I wanted to backtrack just a little bit on your sort of, you know, your life and career, because I worked and lived in Massachusetts for a while. I worked in Fitchburg, which is near where you were born, and in Worcester, Mass, and then you grew up in Gardner.
Right.
That's
Fitchburg was our big rival, in fact. When I was in high school, Fitchburg High School was our rival. So.
And Gardner, that's a beautiful rural area. And then you went to, you went to Nashville and wrote and sold songs and eventually got to Virginia and started writing poems, so, and got into haiku. So was there anything along those lines, you know, that suddenly tripped you into the haiku?
Well, I had actually been writing writing poetry since I was in high school. So that was, you know, that goes back to my earliest roots in Massachusetts. Songwriting is one kind of an extension of poem writing, but it's, you know, has its own kind of needs. Haiku came to me rather specifically when I did arrive in Virginia. I had not actually written haiku prior to that, nor had I spent any time on it thinking about it, or didn't know much about it, was not taught anything about it when I was in school. Many people have had some kind of elementary school introduction to it, and as you say, they're often taught it's a three-line poem in 5-7-5 syllables with a nature reference, and you know, most people I know actually started writing haiku that way, and most people, if they become mature poets, can usually figure out what of that they need to keep or not keep, or you know, so that's not been a problem.
Right.
For me, my personal introduction to haiku was reading Jack Kerouac's novel The Dharma Bums.
Okay.
Kerouac is a very autobiographical writer, and he mentions at one point that one of the chief characters in that book is J.F. Ryder, who is the sobriquet for Gary Snyder.
Right.
And Kerouac and Snyder have this conversation about haiku, and they talk about what it's supposed to be and how it's supposed to connote and the feelings that should, you know, arrive out of that. Also, he mentions a four-volume tome on haiku by a guy named R.H. Blythe. Since I know Kerouac is autobiographical and often factual, I look up R.H. Blythe and see if I can. And of course, this is before internet, so I had to actually look in books to figure this stuff out.
Right.
But I saw that the books, the volumes actually existed. I ordered them. I read them. I found that they were exactly what I needed right at that time in my life. And that was 30 years ago, so that was a natural thing for me to proceed with. Worked very nicely for me.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, another one I wanted to read of yours, because it's another quality. I mean, a lot of haiku tend to be about just a moment in time or a specific thing, and I think it's hard sometimes to capture a longer time frame. So another one I saw of yours that I really like, Thunder Through an Endless Slow Summer. And that's just beautiful, because you like capture the whole, it's like you put the thunder in, but then it's like the exclamation point through the whole long span of summer, which it just kind of ripples and ripples the effects of that. So I don't know, anything you want to say about that? I find it just sort of happens by chance if I can get the long time frame to get in there.
That's one of my favorites also, and it's not one that gets noticed that much, I would say, but yeah, that's one of my favorites. I would say that the sense of elongated time in haiku is something that Alan Burns has credited me with inventing that in haiku. I don't know if I invented it or not, but I'm certainly aware of it, and it's a technique that I've tried on several occasions in a variety of different ways, and it intrigues me. And I think it's important. I think it gives a breadth to some kinds of haiku that need that. That gives that sense of time spreading on. The sense of a haiku as a moment, again, is not necessarily Japanese, although it's something that it's part of our Zen inculcation with haiku that we may have overlaid on that.
Right.
Japanese poets, for the most part, would not say that that's a requirement or even very important. So I don't think that I've done anything that is earth-shaking there, but I do think it's probably fairly unique in English language haiku. And now I see it practiced fairly often. I see other people trying to do that sort of thing. And, you know, I'm usually interested in seeing what they do.
Yeah, it reminds me, I'm not sure if it's Basho or somebody or Busan or one of the masters, but it's reminding me of one that I use when I do teach classes. It's I'm paraphrasing it because I don't have it right in front of me. It's something like, at that pond, the frog is growing old. It's an autumn poem, and just the fact that it mentions the frog is growing old, you know, I ask people, well, you know, how would the guy know that? You know, because it shows that this person is as familiar with that pond year after year after year, and he knows
right.
The frog. So that's another one of those that goes way back that stood out as, you know, see, you can capture a long span of time, even years, in a short haiku.
Right. And that, of course, also has the allusion to the Basho Furuike poem.
Yeah.
So then another the old pond.
Right.
So that's a nice allusion, and you know Haruo Shirane would call the vertical axis, that gives haiku more depth. It's not just referring to its own moment of noticing the frog and how old it is, mm-hmm. but also referring to another poem, which also has something to say about the sense of what the frog is up to and how that might have a resonance in our lives. So that's a very nice poem.
I think, yeah, there's kind of like a lineage thing I find in haiku, like, you know, like you're suggesting, because some first times that I had an experience and wrote a haiku, and then I would read one that was written 300 or 400 years ago, where it was almost the exact experience of some, you know, somebody out underneath the stars or something, and I found that just like a revelation, you know, about how just certain things don't change, and certain of our experiences, and it seems like the haiku consciousness is like a vehicle for that.
I think that's really true, and that may be one of the really attractive things in haiku around the world. It's that, the world is divisive. Cultures are different. People are different. One of the things that haiku does, I think, for many people is it gives us sort of a common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that recognizing that we're not that different, I mean, we certainly are different. I don't feel like... the mind space that we occupy is very similar to the mind space that people occupied when they were in Roman times, say. I mean, the sense of duty to country and nation is completely different than our sense of it now. The sense of individuality is completely different than the sense of it now. There was real no sense of individuality then in a public way.
Uh-huh.
So I think those things are different. But I do think that it's entirely possible to think that people had an experience of that sort, in looking at the stars, in encountering the first breeze of spring and its incipient warmth. I think those things are universal, and I think that that's one of the ways that people find a commonality that I think is important when the rest of the world seems so threatening and so divisive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that's very important shared part of what we do.
Yeah, that's nicely said, because I think that is that's my general sense, that the common thread is what, you know, affects haiku around the world. Now, because you mentioned a few times, and I'm interested to learn a little about what the Japanese, you know, you're saying things that are not as much prominent as far as, you know, the say, in the momentness of that we tend to associate in English. Is there any way to sum up sort of what the Japanese sense, you know, modern sentiment is or way of haiku? Because, you know, it seems like some things that we've taken on in English are maybe, you know, not as much from the Japanese point of view. Or is that like too complicated a distinction to make?
Well, it is a complex question. I do think that there's a couple of ways to sort of go about that. One thing I could do, I'm going to paraphrase this because I don't remember it. I don't have it right in front of me. But Hiroaki Sato, in his book 100 Frogs, makes the comment that the Japanese have used haiku for many purposes. slogans and announcements and greetings and this and that and this and the other, and several things, but rarely, if ever, for Zen. I mean, that's a statement that he makes, mm-hmm. and it's one that I have found to be largely true. Now, that doesn't mean that Basho, who was a Zen priest,
right.
doesn't have a certain kind of grounding in his poems, and that you can't tease out a kind. Certainly, in some of his less known and more didactic poems, there's a good deal of Zen teaching in that going on. But that is to say, on the whole, the notion of Zen as sort of this in your face, have to have this kind of feeling moment in your poem is not what's going on. It's more of a background feeling, just as people who wrote poems in 17th century in English had a Christian background. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily writing Christian poems, though some were.
Right.
They were writing poems that came out of their experiences, and a large part of what their experiences were informed by were their immersion in a Christian culture. So would you say, oh, they're all Christian poets? Well, in a sense, they all are, but only in a sense. And in the larger sense, they are informed by this rather than owned by it. I'd say the same thing would be true of haiku. So that's one possible way of answering that question. Another possible way of answering that question is to say that the knowledge that we get of Japanese practice largely depends on translators, because most of us do not speak Japanese or read Japanese well enough so that we can actually go to the sources. If we do, well, then that's something. And if we do and then also do some translation, that helps other people do it. But we're still at a remove. Let's also say that we are dependent on people like R.H. Blythe. R.H. Blythe had an axe to grind. He was insistent that the way to see haiku was through the Zen point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when he's the main translator of the genre for, 70 years, and he's going to slant all of his readings of things through a certain prism, what you're going to get is seeing those works through that prism. That's what's available. Now that we have more translations available, we can see maybe that was maybe too one-sided an approach. And then again, what we don't have is we don't have a lot of translation of what's happened in Japanese haiku in the last 50 years. They're not any more static than we are. They are very dynamic in what's going on in their practice. And the consequence of that is very, very little of actual Japanese haiku practice is known in the West right now, because nobody's translating it yet, or very few people are. The Red Moon Press did a translation, a four-volume set, led by Richard Gilbert's group in Japan, associated with Kumamoto University. Did a four-volume set of Kaneko Tota's work. Two of the books are essays, extended essays, and two of them are an early and a later selected haiku. So we have 250 of his poems and two of his longer essays on the genre. That's, a drop in the bucket compared to what there is out there. But it's all there is. It's just, there's so little that we can find out, just as I'm sure there's very little of English language practice that has come to Japan over the last half century that isn't dated. An example of that, I just was on a panel at the American Literature Association conference. It was held in D.C. here about 2 months ago. And one of the panels, there were four or five panels, different panels on haiku, and I was on one of them. Of course, I attended the other ones when I could. One of them was a panel on on American haiku. And the panel on American haiku was run by three Japanese scholars, and it ended at Richard Wright. Well, that's more than half a century ago,
right.
And that's the last they know about what's happened in English language haiku.
Amazing.
It is amazing. It's like, it's the same. It's the same in reverse. We don't really have that much of a handle on what's going on there, because it requires good translation and then hopefully translation that is without the heavy bias that somebody like R.H. Blythe brought to his translation. It's complicated.
Yeah. While you're talking the whole Zen thing, it reminds me too that I think sometimes people think, I appreciate like when a haiku is profound and it shows me something I've never thought of before. Like there's one by Chio Ni that I love. It's I think it's a clear water, no front, no back.
Mm.
And that to me is very Zen because it's giving me some perspective that I've never thought of before. It makes me, I could think about that all day. Wow, no front, no back. But then I think sometimes people expect Zen to, they expect it to be, hit you over the head all the time. And a lot of time it's just very commonplace, which, there's some Zen story that's like, the guy starts off being a Zen student and he's like, teach me about Zen. And the master's like, did you clean your rice bowl?
Right.
Yeah. So I think that fits with the haiku where it can be sort of un-Zen like because, Zen is whatever. It's the commonplace in the moment and it's profound. So I think it just covers everything in that sense. Any ones you want to read that you? I mean, I've got a bunch more that I wrote, that I have printed out. But any more that you want to share, or I know you're really busy, so maybe you didn't get time to jot any down.
Well, I'd actually it'd be more interesting to me if you read the ones that were of interest to you. I mean, all of us as writers are what we're trying to do is we're trying to persuade you,
right?
And we're going to put our little network of words together, and we're going to hope that somehow that network has tentacles that reach out and grab you and that, work for you, resonate for you. But we're all kind of in our own worlds. And so it's more interesting to all writers, I think, to know what other people respond to. And it's also worth saying, too, that it's not very common that writers are the best judges of their own work.
Oh, I agree, yeah.
So if we get the opportunity to hear other people's, takes on our work, it's revealing to us. So if you wouldn't mind, like to hear what you've chosen.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's very gracious of you. I appreciate that a lot. I recently had a birthday, so then I came across your beautiful poem, "For My Birthday, Another Trip Around the Sun," because you help remind me, like, oh yeah, that's what it is in the cosmic counting clocks.
Yep.
So that's
yep.
a great one. And then let's see, another one, another beautiful one, "Windy Day, I Think in Music." That's just, that's beautiful in its own way. And then another one, let's see, the time-lapse thing that you capture very well. This one, speaking of the stars we mentioned before, "Camping Alone, One Star, Then Many." So that's another one to me that's just beautifully, you get the time lapse, and I'm right with you there, whether you're sitting outside or in a tent, I don't know, but you've shown me the time frame between seeing the first star and then the rest. So it's like you've given me a couple of hours out there in just, a few words. So that's a beautiful one too.
Oh, thank you.
And let's see. And then, some other ones where you're very, it's like appeals to the average common man's plight, so to speak. "New Moon, Another Chance to Make It Right." That's a nice one. And then I got to paraphrase it because I'm not sure I have it in front of me, but you had one about drinking whiskey till it loves you or something like that.
Yes, yes. Sipping whiskey till it loves me.
Yeah. A nice feel. It says a lot about the human condition. And one more with the human thing too, because one of the things of sort of rules of haiku is sort of, I say it's like highlighting it. It's like I forgot the term. I always forget the name of that term. It's like using a small thing to reflect the large. There's some poetic term for that.
Metonymy.
That's probably it. Yeah, you have passing the jug, the warmth of many hands. So that's beautiful because you highlight on the whole experience of being with a bunch of people and drinking, and it's not just the drinking or the getting drunk. It's the warmth of many hands. That's a nice one too. All right, we've got a little bit of time left. There's so many things, but maybe you could touch on a little bit of all your activities and maybe say where things are going in the future. You first off, you started Red Moon Press back in 1993, and from what I read, that's probably the one of the most, if not the most prominent haiku publishing houses in the U.S.
Well, let me start by saying thank you for that very nice reading of those poems.
Oh, you're welcome.
Those are all particular favorites of mine, and and most of them are pretty well known. And those are all very nice to hear. Favorable readings of, and obviously you like them, and it shows. So thank you for that.
One more I want to ask you about, if I can just jump in.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, there was one, Deep in Space, The Red Shift of My Mind. Now, I have a native friend who's Lakota. He interviewed him on the show, and he had mentioned the red shift phenomenon to me, so I'm presuming you might be alluding to that. It's like a cosmic phenomenon, something along those lines?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Redshift is it's like you've heard when you've been on a street and a fire truck has come by or a police car has come by you with the siren on, and you hear when it's approaching you, it has one pitch, and after it's gone by you, it's got a different pitch. It's lower pitch.
Right.
This has to do with the fact that when it's coming towards you, the sound waves are being pushed towards you, and it gets to a higher frequency. After it's past you, the sound waves are still coming back at you, but it's coming back minus the speed that the vehicle's going away.
Okay.
So it lowers the pitch. So it's called the Doppler effect. We've heard that fairly commonly. The same thing occurs along the electromagnetic spectrum, and light, of course, is one of the elements of the electromagnetic spectrum. So when objects are approaching us, they have we see them at one speed or at one intensity, and when they leave or they are receding from us, we have to read them in a different way, minus the amount of speed at which they're receding. That shift is called the red shift.
Okay.
It's because it's moving towards the red area of the light spectrum, and the approach is called the blue shift because it's getting towards the blue end of the spectrum. So, yeah, the redshift, I'm very, very conscious of that. And there's a lot in that poem that's suggestive of, you know, what we can know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for one thing, the fact that we have to account for a redshift, not only in that, but in all of our lives, in anything we think about, really. One way of thinking about it is, you know, when we look at a star, we're not looking at the star today, presently. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the star that many light years ago when it emitted that beam. So, you know, the sun, we're not looking at the sun. We're looking at the sun 8 minutes ago. That's an interesting thing.
That's a haiku right there. I like that.
So, yeah. And if, you know, some of these stars that we're looking at have already exploded, but we won't know it until that light comes from the, you know, if they're coming from 100 million light years away, we won't know it for 100 million years after it explodes. And it's the redshift that is, you know, that we're aware of the way it's receding.
Now, this has stirred up a lot. I'm trying to connect some dots here, because one of my interests in with haiku, and I have a lot of interest in indigenous culture, native culture, so I find the connection with nature is very common in both, and also the kind of sense of a kind of like a nature science which indigenous people have. And maybe I've been reading a little bit about the Shinto, which maybe you know something about, maybe because they have a lot to do with, you know, respect for nature spirits. Now, is it possible, like, the Shinto has affected haiku, say, more than Zen, or, you know, maybe not more, but anything along those lines that you know, that, because I hardly know anything about that Shinto?
I wouldn't want to say more than,
right.
But I would say that it is another one of the elements in the background.
Right.
You know, in Western culture, people tend to be Christian, or they tend to be anti-Christian, you know, atheist or agnostic,
right.
You know, and that's pretty much, that defines a large part of what they do. But in Asiatic cultures, there's really a much more fluid sense of religiosity and one's participation in the religious realm. So one might well be a Buddhist and also a Confucianist and also a Taoist and also a Shintoist.
Okay.
I mean, it's like, you're not worried about the overlap, and you're not worried if some of these things are slightly incongruous or even incompatible. We do the same thing. We just don't admit it to ourselves. You know, if you look at Christian thought and act, action, you'll see that there are lots of contradictions all the time, but that doesn't change people from saying that they're Christians. Many Catholics don't believe, for example, that birth control is against God's will, mm-hmm. but they practice it and they don't believe it, but they still say they're Catholic because they mostly believe what Catholicism teaches. It's just not a factor so much in Eastern thought. And so Shinto would certainly be one of the underpinnings right. of that. And Shinto is very caught up. It's a kind of animism
right.
where there is belief in the deities of the trees, of the water. You know, and the gods are called kami. Mm-hmm. You know, they're little spirits that inhabit these different things.
Right.
We've had that kind of thing in earlier cultures. I mean, certainly some of Greek thought. And earlier than that, you'll find a kind of pantheism that is, I don't want to say identical to, but similar to what Shinto brings to it. And do I think Shinto is involved in haiku? I certainly think Shinto is one of the driving forces, underlying forces in early, in all of early Japanese writing. Red Moon Press just published the Kojiki, which is the earliest extant book in Japanese culture, and that's all about Shinto. It's, you know, it's all about spirits inhabiting mountains and forests and having an effect on the way that people's lives are led, and how the Japanese leading family, which is what the Kojiki is about, it's about lineage. Mm-hmm. It's how the ruling families came to possess the culture and the country, and how they interacted with the gods, and how they interacted with each other, mostly by killing each other. But I mean, you know, that's true of all cultures. There's nothing new there.
All right. Wow. That's interesting topic. I'm remembering. Probably Blythe mentions he's got some graph in one of the volumes where he shows all the influences on haiku, and I'm pretty sure Shinto is in there. But
yeah, it sure is. Yes.
Thanks for adding that, because that's added another layer to my interest. All right, in the time remaining, maybe you can sort of say a little bit about, Red Moon Press, and then I also wanted to have you mention the Haiku Foundation as well. So those are two huge parts of what you do, you know, for promoting, for lack of a better word, haiku, you know, worldwide. So maybe start with Red Moon Press.
Red Moon Press was founded in 1993. As I say this a lot, Red Moon Press is the largest dedicated publisher of haiku in the world.
Wow.
Which makes us a very, very small company.
I was like, I'm not going to say something like that, but I'm glad you said it.
That's exactly it. That's a joke, but it's also, it's true, and it's true in kind of a deep way, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we do more than anybody else, but it's still, we're such a niche market, and we're such a small group of, small community that, you know, we are small, and we know that. Doesn't affect us, you know, in terms of, you know, what we want to do, though. I mean, the reason why anybody would get involved with small press, never mind a small press with a niche audience, is certainly not money. It's because you think it's important to do what you're doing, and that's always been our driving force. I started Red Moon Press in 1993 because I had just taken on a journal, South by Southeast, and I wanted to be able to control the publication of it. So I had to do it in some way, and there were a variety of ways that were possible. The best way, in my mind, was simply to learn how to do all that stuff. So I did. That's what I wanted to do. My first book came out, or the first book of the press came out in 1996. So the first 3 years or so was just journal publication, South by Southeast. And we did a couple of small things that were supplements to that or broadsides. But our first book was End Grain by D. Evitz in 1996. Since then, we've produced about 200 books, almost all of them haiku, all of them related to haiku in some fashion. Red Moon Press has, I think, had a huge impact on the way that haiku is read and received and has grown around the world. One of the most important things that happened to Red Moon Press was in 2005. My friend Dave Russo, who's also on the board and is the web designer for the Haiku Foundation, created a website for Red Moon Press, which is the same website that we still have. So it's been, you know, 10 years in the running. And what that did was it essentially opened up Red Moon Press products to the rest of the world. And I would say that fully a third, if not more than a third, of our sales now go overseas.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And that's been very important, again, since we're a niche operation and since we don't make any money. The larger the audience, the better for us. I stated right at the beginning of founding the press that my goal, I'm not a wealthy person, my goal was to lose less than $1,000 a year. That's not a great business model, as you can probably guess. Most years I've succeeded, but not all years.
No. Oh, well, yeah, I wish you more, wonderful what you do. I wish you good luck with it, in however way it helps you.
Thank you. And anyway, the website has been very important. Yeah. Not an outgrowth of the press, but an outgrowth of some thinking about what else is necessary in haiku, how can it grow, resulted in creation of the Haiku Foundation. I started thinking about the Haiku Foundation in about 2004 and talked to some people about it, got some feedback. What did people think about these ideas? What I mostly thought about during that time, there were a fair number of organizations already in place at that time, and most of those organizations worked in the same way. They were membership organizations where you sent in, your dues, or some were free, but I mean you joined in some fashion, and in response to your joining, you got the opportunity to submit some work and have it published potentially in the house journal, for the Haiku Society of America, for example, that would be Frog Pond. Mm-hmm. There were occasional independent operations like Modern Haiku, which was simply a journal in which you submitted to. But in all of these instances, the real focus was on serving the poet. It's like, I'm going to join this, and in response to that, I'm going to be able to attend some conferences, and I'll get some of my work published, maybe.
Right.
That was kind of the model. And that's great. That's a good model. It's necessary, and it's what a lot of people want to do. My focus for the Haiku Foundation really was the opposite of that, though. My focus for the Haiku Foundation was, how can we serve haiku rather than how can we serve haiku poets? Hmm. And I figured if we serve haiku well, poets will be well served. So I started thinking about how can I do that? What kinds of things would I like to see? What kind of things do I think would be of interest to other people, but also serve the genre? And I came up with a few ideas, most of which did not get implemented in our startup. We're starting to do some of them a little bit more now. But in all instances, what I really wanted to do was I wanted to make sure that I created a place where people could say, I want to see this happen, and we could give them the space and the opportunity and maybe some technical know-how and maybe some physical volunteer help to actually realize this. So, for instance, there is at that time, there was no extant digital library. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very important that at some point haiku have a commodious digital library. So we started one. Now, how does that work? That works basically by people sending things to us that we can store and make available, rather than having 100,000 individual things in 100,000 different places. All those things get gathered in one place with a kind of card catalog, and you can file through and see what you need. That's, I think, a boon for anybody who would be doing scholarship or research in haiku. It'd be much harder to try and find those 100,000 items individually. Not impossible, but really, right. Really hard. So that would be one idea. A recent thing that happened, for example, on the Haiku Foundation, a poet from Sweden named Anna Maris approached me and said, I would really like to do a series of comparative poems on homelessness. Hmm. So we did that, and we're in the fourth week right now out of six. So that's the kind of thing that works for the Haiku Foundation. Wow. It's the place where poets go to give back to haiku. Haiku's been very good to most poets. It's not a monetary thing, but it's
right.
There's a nice sense of community. There's opportunities to publish. It's collegial. It's a wonderful group of people.
That's beautifully said.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, the website, so people can check it out, thehaikufoundation.org.
That's correct.
I've looked on it a bunch of times. There's so much on there, and it's neat the way you're, you know, integrating using the technology of the day to help, you know, accentuate this, you know, ancient art, really.
It's good to bring haiku into the 21st century, absolutely.
Now, speaking of that, I've got a collection of haiku books. I've not gotten to your most, I think it's your most recent one. It looks very fascinating. Haiku in English, the First 100 Years, which was a collaboration with several other writers, including the one I recognize, Billy Collins, because he's probably the most well-known poet in America today.
Yes, probably right.
Yeah, well, can you just like sum up a little bit about that book, Haiku in English, the First 100 Years?
Haiku in English, which was published by Norton in 2013, is the culmination of about 15 years of work. I first had the idea, I could tell a long story about it, but I'll try to make it brief since I think we're probably getting short on time here. Cor van den Heuvel published three volumes of what he called the Haiku Anthology. It is the premier anthology of haiku in English through its third edition, which is 1999. Following that, and Cor had a specific model. Each of the three editions is different. Mm-hmm. The first one, 1974, was simply collecting haiku from all the haiku poets he knew that were any good in English. Mm-hmm. It was groundbreaking in its way. Nothing like that had been done before. It allowed a kind of conversation to take place in the poetic community that had not been there before. The second volume in 1986 was an expansion of that and also a slight change in terms of its orientation. There were many more people writing haiku now, and so there could be a lot more discrimination in terms of what was included and what, you know, how had the genre grown, how had it improved, what had it learned. So the second volume, to my mind, is the best of the three. It takes that initial impetus and also refines it and brings haiku to a much more developed place. The third volume in 1999 largely repeats the second volume while it exchanges some poems for others and adds some new poets and drops a few others. But its conception is very similar to the one that was in 1986. Following that, I had a conversation with Cor, and I was interested in doing the haiku anthology back in the late 90s when it appeared he was not going to do a third volume. And in fact, I had a conversation with him in which he said he was not going to do a third volume. And then he told me that at a party at Hiro Sato's house in New York. And a week later, he was at another party and had shared that conversation with me with a fellow editor. Cor was a professional editor. He shared that conversation with a fellow editor who was, of course, a contemporary. And this contemporary, Bob Wheel, at that time at Norton, said, "Cor, you can't let these young whippersnappers have all the fun." And so Cor thought about it, and he said, "Well, maybe I can do a third." So, and a year later, he produced the third volume. He told me right away that, you know, I changed my mind, I am going to do it. So I did, although I had started a little bit of work, it was a brief amount.
Right.
But I already knew that it was something I was going to do. And I also knew that it was going to be different than what Cor did, because Cor's take, as valuable as it was, had a very specific impetus. He was really interested in American haiku, and he was interested in a particular kind of American haiku. So a lot of the pieces are very much in the same kind of mode. You didn't really get a sense of really how broad the genre was, and you certainly didn't get a sense that it was being practiced outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two of the issues that I wanted to address in my volume. So it took from 1998, when Cor and I had that conversation, to 2013, when the volume was actually published, also by Norton, for me to realize that dream. But that's how long it took. I needed to do that.
Amazing.
I refined my ideas through the course of an earlier version that I had produced with a couple of colleagues in the mid-2000s. And then the final version was produced over the course of about 3 years. Phil Roland and Alan Burns and I literally looked at hundreds of thousands of poems. We used the database that Charlie Trumbull has created, plus our additional readings, and we went through every haiku poet's complete work that we had, you know, access to, which was just about everybody, and tried to supplement what was missing, which was very little, with our own readings. And we had weekly discussions. We would meet on Tuesday nights via Skype. So this is a 21st century compilation. We'd meet via Skype, and the sessions usually ran 5 or 6 hours.
Wow.
I mean, they were long, long sessions. And during that time, we would be discussing the work of maybe three poets. That was how we proceeded. And it took us 3 years to get through the massive work that we needed to do. Hmm. So then we arrived at kind of a final product. The idea is to show haiku not just as a product of the haiku community, which I think is what the haiku anthology does. In other words, it starts really in the early 1960s and runs through its present time, which, as I say, ends in 1999. So it's a compilation of 40 years of American haiku, and does that job very nicely. Haiku in English is a study of the English language haiku from 1894, the earliest translations of Lafayette O'Hearn, through 2012, which is when the deadline for our editing could be done, so that they could produce the book by 2013. And in that, we look not only at American haiku, but at haiku written in English around the world, most of which is written in English as the first language, but not exclusively. There are poets who write English language haiku, even though it's their second or even third language, because English is the lingua franca, if you will, right, of haiku in the world today. It would have been Japanese, you know, 200 years ago, if there were such a thing as worldwide haiku then. But worldwide haiku today is conducted, the discussions are conducted in English. So, we had to look at poets from India. We had to look at poets from Scandinavia, Central Europe, Western Europe, not just Australia and New Zealand and the UK and Canada and the United States. So it was a fascinating project, and it brought us into contact with lots of people we might not have otherwise connected with. Another of the goals was to trace the activity of haiku, or the action of haiku, on the minds of poets who were not primarily haiku poets. So while there's a lot of the haiku community in haiku in English, there's also poems by people who would not be considered mainstream haiku poets. I'm sorry, would not be considered haiku poets, but mainstream poets. Right. Richard Wright, Wallace Stevens, Ezra Pound, who's, you know, sort of famously involved there, but E.E. Cummings, Richard Wilbur, Billy Collins, as you've already mentioned. These people come to haiku from the Western poetic tradition, and their take on haiku is an interesting conversation with it as well. John Ashbery. There's a range in haiku in English that far supersedes anything that you could find in the haiku anthology by design. That's what we wanted to explore. Plus, there's a 70-page overview on the history of haiku in English, which I wrote specifically for that volume, which is
awesome.
I'm hoping is the sort of the definitive word on that. I'm sure it will get refined and improved over time, but I think it's the bedrock upon which we can sort of proceed.
Wow, that's the plan. Amazing explanation, Jim. Yeah, that book's on my list. I looked a bit of it online, and it looked quite fascinating. I got one more question, and then I got one more of your haiku I want to finish up with. Any of your plans, you know, for the future? Like, are you planning to continue world traveling, or kind of hunker down and garden and write haiku, or don't you know?
Well, I think that there's always a tension between those elements of things. Right now, I'm sort of in a very public phase of my life.
Right.
I spend an inordinate amount of time working on projects for the foundation, and quite a lot of my time working on projects for the press, and a very little amount of my time working on my own work. And I would like at some point to change that balance some.
Right.
But I do feel like I have, there are more things I need to accomplish with the foundation to give it the stability and the organization that it needs to proceed past my time, my involvement with it.
Right.
So that's my first goal, is to make the organization not need me. So I'm gonna spend time on that. The press, I think, is a really important part of what I do. I don't see that changing anytime soon, but I do see probably the focus of the press changing a little bit. I think, you know, again, entering the 21st century here, I think that we are increasingly, the press will be doing electronic versions, you know, EPUBs and e-books.
Right.
So we'll be changing how we do business to some degree. I don't think we'll ever get away entirely from print, but some will change.
Mm-hmm.
And then personally, I don't have anything planned on the horizon until Hiking North America 2015, which is a year away from now. It's next October. But I, you know, I get a lot of invitations to speak and to travel, and I am sure that I will avail myself of those periodically. I may not do as many as I once did,
right?
Because I do want to spend more time writing. I have several writing projects that I would personally like to take up, and I, you know, I do well when I am busy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't really think I need to, you know, quit everything and just write. I think actually that would probably be the worst thing I could do. But it would be nice to create a little bit more time in my life for those activities.
Right.
And I haven't quite figured out how to do that. I'll be working towards that.
All right. Good luck. Yeah. Thanks so much. I mean, as someone who haiku is such a big part of my life, I just, you know, I thank you for all you're doing for, you know, like you said, for haiku. And that's a wonderful way to look at it, not just for the poets, but for haiku, and then let the poets get from there. So, you know, really wonderful. Congratulations and good luck with, you know, ongoing projects.
Thank you.
Now I wanted to read one more of yours, and then that'll wrap it up. For all the, you know, I think it was there's a Basho quote that was something like, to write good haiku, get a 3-foot child.
I think that's
so this one of yours is like, for all the talk about this and about that and how we tend to intellectualize, this poem is like a kid wrote it. On a glad morning, I am glad, spring sun. And woman, can you read it again so I hear your voice?
On a glad morning, I am glad, spring sun.
Yeah, I love that you repeat the word glad. It's so like, no, you're not supposed to repeat the word. But there you, that's how glad you are. So,
yeah.
Thanks so much, Jim. I really appreciate you. You know, I know how busy you are, so it's great to talk with you, and thanks so much for doing this.
Monk, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All righty.
And before the outro music, just wanted to make an editorial note and mention, since this culture of Japan is so rich, the arts and spiritual traditions, wanted to call attention to Fukushima, and from what I've heard, there's no known technological solution to the nuclear plant where radioactive water has been pouring into the Pacific Ocean for some years now, I think 3 years. And so there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Emoto who has done studies, you can look him up online, showing how water responds to emotions and prayers, negative or condescending emotion would affect the molecules. There's some photos where they show the molecules are kind of distorted, whereas loving, positive, harmonious energy towards the water creates beautiful, shining, crystally, starlit kind of energy. So I want to get the opportunity of making the mention to let people know this, so that they can send their prayers and good thoughts and healing energies to the people of Japan there in that area, and to all the relations, and to the waters and the air and whatever else, whomever else, whatever else you can think of. The water in the oceans can ultimately affect all of the water with the earth, so important thing to help send some good energy to. And we'll go out with a track from a CD called Patterns of Plants by Mamoru Fujieda. Played one of these tracks a while back on the show. It's in brief, some guy did like hooked up, put electrodes onto plants and then transferred the vibrations onto computer and then put that into music. Thank you.